problems. This is something I'm developing, I want to work on. This is something I would like your help with. This is something we want to get a development team for, together for. So far we have one person that has volunteered to help out with this. So please see me afterwards. We're not really asking that much, just for you to try out this activity with your students, and then looking for people prepared to try it out, and then report back on what they think and how it went, and how we can improve that. And then ultimately looking at putting the resource on the website, and all of the teachers that have been involved in that, we will acknowledge them on the website. So so really we need your help to make this really good, student-friendly and suitable for the class. And also, I think Ed has about 10 people, Ed's not here, that have signed up, that are willing to help out try the LED lab. Roberta's face.
Nobody wants an entanglement, but if you change your mind, let me know. But I have two people for space-time diagrams, and anybody else who wants to talk to me, you can sign for that.
Okay.
It doesn't involve a lot of drinking, Ron.
What? Oh, yes, it will.
Yeah, okay,
great.
Yeah, got you, yes.
Okay.
Yes, you were volunteered by me.
Oh. And so this will be a way, is anyone interested in keeping in touch from this week?
Sure.
Generally, okay. Well, what we actually have an electronic mailing list.
Yeah.
There is set up. Would everyone like to be put on that?
Yes.
Okay. So so I will send an email to everyone else after that. So that's, yep, Angela.
I'm coming to try to do a workshop with some teachers who came last year, but
yep.
If anybody had any ideas, like if they were thinking of doing the same thing back in their districts, then I'd really be interested. I don't know if other people would be interested.
Yeah.
Some ideas about how to present that information.
Like a workshop outline?
Yeah, like we generally have, like, you can do, say, a 2-hour part of the day or something,
right.
And invite other teachers in the region to come. So,
yeah.
I'd really like to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
You know that the teachers in your area who have been before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if we could have the list of the people from the other sessions, that's a big crowd. So there can be a Toronto group that is meeting,
right.
And then there's a Newfoundland group that's meeting, and heck, Saskatoon, I don't know. You can have
Edmonton,
yeah.
Yeah.
So if I somehow get hold of those,
yeah, that's a good idea. So we want to keep in touch by the electronic mailing list, and I'll send you about that. That's a very good way. There's one. Yep. Okay. And so what we will actually be sending out at this stage, quarterly newsletters and updates of some kind, because if we really want just to keep in touch and keep at least you really need just to refresh things, keep constantly in your mind. So we'll be sending out quarterly sort of updates about how people have applied these new techniques and how things are actually progressing. And we do encourage you, also, if anyone else is interested in doing some sort of PD session on something that you've learned here, please, I encourage you to do that. Please see me about that. I'm happy to try and provide any support I can. Someone mentioned me going to Saskatoon. I'm actually due to go there in October, late October, to the Science Teachers Conference is there. So this guy, Patrick Cosman?
That's in October 27th.
Something like that, yeah. So here, Saskatchewan is an incredibly beautiful province.
You can see it on the border of
that. Okay, right. Yeah, we'll do that now. Oh, actually. Okay. So that's all about keeping in touch. And again, this is something we want to do actually as a service to disc teachers everywhere around the world. Put stuff on the web. Okay, so the GPS and relativity. So this is something I was very excited and I thought was really cool. And I found out that the GPS, this navigation technology used by millions of people around the planet, actually involves Einstein's, actually both special relativity and general relativity. We'll just look at special relativity. And the military engineers that actually built it in the 60s used the time dilation formula that from special relativity. But and essentially, because the timing mechanism is so precise, you actually need to correct for relativistic effects. And if you did not, the GPS completely would not work. So this is kind of an example that even though it's modern physics, it is very abstract, it is very esoteric. Ultimately, quantum physics, quantum theory, and relativity are the most accurate descriptions of humanity today of the real physical world out there. And that eventually our knowledge, our understanding, knowledge is power, it feeds into technologies. And we find traces of modern physics everywhere. I mean, it's just that they're hidden. But students do not know about them. When you know, when you have an iPod or a computer, it does not say to you, you know, brought to you by modern physics. But it's there. You need quantum physics to understand those. So another part of our outreach programs, from time to time, we have what we call a Physica Fantastica tour. And we actually go have people, scientists or outreach staff from these actually go out to schools and give presentations in classes. So this year has just been within Ontario, but we do anticipate going across the country sometime. Sometime next year. I don't want to promise anything, but we have actually been, before people have been actually out to a number of different provinces. So normally we go to, at the moment, grade 11 and 12 physics classes. And this is, I did that this year. And this is the list of the places we went to in Ontario. And this is actually a photo of me giving this presentation in, that's actually at Manitoulin Island. And that's actually Markfield Secondary College in just kind of north of Toronto. So giving the presentation I'm essentially about to give to you now. And so again, I'd actually learned a lot by giving this to sort of class after class and figuring out what worked and what didn't work. And a lot of what did work and what didn't work kind of surprised me. So this is what we'll look at. So this is sort of the condensed version just of the global positioning system. But what I find is kids know about it. They know about GPS as a navigation tool. And up above us right now, 20,000 kilometers up above the surface of the Earth, are 24 satellites. And they're orbiting around in various patterns. Basically, they orbit around the Earth once every 12 hours. And continually, these are the GPS satellites. I launched, I think it was the early 1990s. And they form the core of the GPS navigation system. And what they're doing is continually all the time sending out radio waves, just 24/7. And all the satellites are all in different orbits. And if you have a GPS receiver, and these are the devices you can buy for maybe $100 or $200 from Canadian Tire, from hiking stores. They're very accessible. And a number of schools, their geography departments have them. So they're not expensive or esoteric devices. And if you actually have a GPS receiver, then you pick up these radio waves, these signals from the GPS satellites. Or you actually, technically, so you, some of them, you actually pick up the signals from the satellites that are above the horizon from where you are. So some of them are on the other side of the Earth, and obviously the signals don't travel through the Earth. But basically you pick up signals from some of the satellites above the horizon. And by picking up signals from multiple satellites, the basic idea is you do some sort of triangulation process, and you can pinpoint down where you are on the surface of the planet down to within round about a couple of meters. And that's how the GPS system works. Talk a little bit more in detail about it. But just in terms of practicality, it's used by hikers to help keep on trails, to navigate their way around. It's used by taxi drivers and emergency service vehicles to get to their destinations quicker. And if you've ever seen satellite navigation in cars, where you see the little TV screen in a car or a taxi, and you have a computer image of the streets, you have a little dot in the car, or the computer voice says, you know, turn left at the third street or turn right at the next street, that's satellite navigation that uses GPS. Some farmers actually use it to help plant their crops in straight lines on their tractors. People use it in the construction industry, actually to help when they have plans for a new apartment complex or shopping center. Obviously, you have the blueprint for that, and you have the bulldozer drivers. They need to know where to dig there's going to be a ramp here or a basement here. They need to know, okay, it's going to be 10 meters wide, 5 meters from the edge. They need to know where to start digging, how deep, and so forth. And people actually use GPS for that. Also, planes use it to land, especially in bad weather. Henry.
It's important to emphasize that these satellites just send a signal, and the unit receives. The students have this conception that it sends out a signal to the satellite.
Right. Yeah. So it's, absolutely. That's important. So it's just a one-way thing. So it's just from the satellite to the receiver. Yep. Absolutely. So how does it work? So it works is, okay, where's the... Okay. So here we have one GPS satellite up in the sky, sends out a radio wave here, and what these actually have is what are called time codes. So basically, the signal sent out here tells you exactly what time it was emitted from the satellite. So it might be 12 o'clock, exactly 12 noon, that it was emitted from the satellite. So the signal says, yep, this was sent at exactly 12 noon. And you have a person down there on Earth, they have a GPS receiver. And so they have this little handheld receiver. They pick up this signal. They see, okay, it was emitted exactly 12 noon. They can tell that. They can just read that off from the signal it contains at the radio wave. And then they look at the GPS receiver. There's a clock inside that. It just looks to see what the time is. And it might be 1 minute past 12. So you know, then the signal took 1 minute to get from the satellite to you, hypothetically. So that's the signal, time. But, well, how fast does the signal travel? So it's radio waves. It's electromagnetic radiation. Pretty much it was traveling through empty space the entire way. So what speed does electromagnetic radiation, like light, X-rays, gamma rays, travel through empty space? They all travel at the speed of light, c, 3 by 10 to 8 meters per second. So you know the speed. And so assuming constant speed, we have speed, distance equals speed multiplied by time. So what we do is we get the time, we get the speed, therefore we can know how far we are away from that satellite. So if you know how far you are away from that satellite, you think of all the points that are that distance, some particular distance, equidistant away from a satellite, all those points actually form the surface of a sphere. So you've got a sphere or a ball right in the middle, you've got the satellite, and all the points of the surface of the sphere or the ball is exactly the same distance away from the satellite. So you know you're somewhere on the surface of that sphere. Now, it's kind of hard to draw a sphere here, so I've just drawn a circle, and you think of all of these points here. All of these, if you were around at all of those points, you would have got the same time signal, because the light would have taken sort of 1 minute to get to all of those points. And I guess a bit more accurately, you know that, well, you know you're on the surface of the Earth, so you know you're kind of somewhere along this arc here, you know you're not sort of floating out in outer space. So that information you get from one satellite, it's enough to give you some information about where you are, but it's not enough. So what you need to do is repeat the process. And when you repeat the process, you know you're at the intersection of two spheres, or in this case, the intersection of two circles. So you get some more information about what you are. And roughly speaking, if you get information from three satellites, then that's enough to pinpoint where you are. They do actually use four, but four is essentially some sort of a check. And so one intuitive way, basically, of seeing why you need to get signals from three different satellites to pinpoint where you are is to find out where you are on the surface of the Earth. You want to know three coordinates. You want to know three things. You want to know your latitude, how much you are above the equator or below the equator. You want to know the other coordinate, your longitude, how far you are away from around from Greenwich zero longitude. And also you want to know what your altitude is, how high you are above sea level or how far you are below. So there's three coordinates, and so therefore you need information from three satellites. And basically that's enough to do some sort of triangulation process, figure out, bam, wherever you are on the planet, down to within a couple of meters. So essentially, that's actually a list of uses there. So you may be wondering, well, yes.
From the previous slide, signal carry time information, like you said, because it also tell where the satellite is located?
Oh, yes, it does. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So it has to tell you what satellite is located, or it has to tell you what satellite it is. So, yeah.
Fabian,
yep.
I didn't think the GPS would tell that, because you're going to go people with the do diving, and they have to have another system to tell them. Will it tell your office?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. It can. I mean, it might be if you're diving, that would be complicated by the fact that the radio waves would have to travel through the water, which, yeah, it's not very good at doing that, but yeah. Okay, so far we haven't explicitly mentioned relativity, we haven't mentioned Einstein. I've just talked about knowing where you are with timing and so forth. Where does Einstein actually come into it? Where it actually comes into it is basically the satellites are, so they're moving, basically rubber heads right now, they're zipping around, and they're moving around from our reference frame around about 4 kilometers every single second. So 4 kilometers per second compared to the speed of light, it's very, very small, but it's not negligible, it's not nothing. And so that basically because... I thought I turned it off. So because you have this speed that's not negligible, what you have is, in a sense, the clock on the GPS satellite, because they actually all have atomic clocks on them. All of the GPS satellites have atomic clocks, which are the most accurate clocks we have in the world. And I think they are rubidium clocks up there at the moment. So they have these the most accurate clocks, and so with these clocks, we know this kind of sense that if we're looking at an observer and they're moving relative to us, we get time dilation. We see their time is running slow, we see their clocks is running slowly, and so that happens with the satellites. We actually see the satellite clock is running slowly. So the time signals, as a result that we get out, they're actually sort of off. By the amount of time dilation. So this clock is running slowly, and so what you actually have to do is you get the time signals from the satellite with your GPS receiver, and then you actually need to adjust for those. You actually need to correct for those, basically this relativistic time slowdown, and because you know the clock is running slowly, adjust for that, and that is where relativity comes into it. And it's actually just, you may think, well, 4 kilometers per second compared to the speed of light, which is 300,000 kilometers per second. You may think, well, you know, that's just a small amount. It's not even 1%. Surely it doesn't matter. If you actually do the math, the time dilation factor is not much. But the point is, the system is so precise, you actually need to take that into account. And the military engineers, when they were building it, they actually did take that into account. So we have the time dilation formula there that expresses that the fact that we have a clock, the satellite clock, for example, that's ticking away at a certain rate. How much time between each tick on that clock will, on the surface of the Earth, it's moving relative to us, will perceive as occurring will be, we have to sort of, in a sense, magnify the time. So it won't be 1 second, but 1 second multiplied by gamma. Gamma is the Lorentz factor, or I'd like to think of it as time slowdown factor. And that actually is something we can, it's really a function of velocity. It gets bigger and bigger the greater the velocity is. And so if you, again, we saw this yesterday, but if you plot as a function of speed, it's 1 for a speed of 0, there's no time slowdown, which makes sense. We don't see this weird time slowdown behavior with light, with trains or with cars or people walking, but actually as you get higher and higher velocity, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. These weird special relativistic effects become more and more extreme, and it actually becomes infinite up there. So this is the formula. So initially what I started doing was basically telling the students, okay, you figure out what the time dilation factor is for these clocks going at 4 kilometers per second. And so I basically told them, okay, you've got 4 kilometers per second, you know, C is 300,000 kilometers per second, plug the numbers in and tell me what gamma is, tell me what the correction factor is, So everyone, the students were getting out their calculators, and they basically, the calculators couldn't handle it because the numbers were so small, so everyone was giving me the answer 1. So basically 99.9 students were just saying, oh, it's 1, it's nothing. So then I decided, okay, I have to change things. So then I started saying, okay, well, that's kind of a complicated formula to use. So what we can do, and trust me on this one, is we can actually use a certain approximation. So that's complicated with the square root. And it turns out that at least when the velocity is small, we can actually use an approximation here. And this is actually equal to 1 plus b squared divided by 2 c squared. And I kind of mentioned in passing, well, if you've heard of something called the binomial expansion, and maybe one or two students out of every class would nod their head, this is what you can actually use. So how I've gotten this, again, I just gave it to the students and found they accepted it and they trusted me. And you can actually check that for yourself. If you want to, I mean, you can calculate this, you can plot a graph, you can calculate this and plot on a graph, and you can actually see that the two coincide at least when the is it too large. But if you want to know how you actually get that, there's something called the binomial expansion, and if you have 1 plus x all to the power n, you can calculate that it's actually 1 plus nx plus n minus 1 x squared divided by 2 plus n minus, and you can see the terms there. And so if the velocity is much smaller than the speed of light, then you have just higher, so v squared over c squared, v is much less than c, v squared over c squared is going to be tiny, and then for x squared, we actually have v to the fourth divided by c to the fourth, and that's like this really small number squared. If you get a small number and you square it, you get an even tinier number, and here we get this even small number, and we cube it, you get an even tinier number, and so as you go higher and higher order with terms, turns out they get smaller and smaller and smaller. They just get insignificant. And you just do not need to worry about those. So you can just say approximately, for very, very small x, 1 plus x to the n is equal to 1 plus nx. And so this is all we've done here. I guess we've just... express that as that like that, and so n equals minus a half, and so that was that, therefore. Plus. And then so that's how we get that there. Just representing that, sort of moving that into the form 1 plus 1 minus something, and then take that all to the power of that, and then just use the substitution, n, if the power is minus half, and the x is the minus v squared divided by c squared, and then substitute into that formula, and that's how you get that. But what I found, if I just said it with enough conviction, and so trust me, I'm a physicist, the students seem to accept that. But
it's a very quick one. As a math teacher, it may seem like a nitpick, but if in the second equation you could just make Wiggly equal signs,
then
we'd all be happy.
Okay, yeah, there. Yeah, okay, thanks. Yeah, okay.
I think it's good for the kids, too, because otherwise you might send somebody away that has a misunderstanding of how they've been not quite.
Okay, to the kids, your kids, aren't just, you teach them Wiggly signs?
Yeah, or even a plus dot, 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 but then all your words are right in terms of talking about that kind of small thing. But on the face of it, you look at those two equations, and that could create issues.
Okay, good, okay, yeah. Actually, this is the kind of exactly the feedback I'll make a note. Yep.
Wiggly minds.
No. Just because you missed me, because I know in my head, well, that's just approximate, but...
Yeah, you said all the right words.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so I got to this stage, and then I started telling the kids at schools, okay, calculate this. So they got their calculators out, And v squared divided by c squared, it's very, very small. And so basically they got this tiny number, and when they added it to 1, the calculator would just give them the answer 1. So we're getting 99.9 students. We're coming back and saying, oh, it's 1. There's no effect. It's just 1. And I thought, okay, I have to think about this.
It's a little bit the FE got on the calculator.
Yeah. The FE?
Get the calculator for the decks. Like, put it in a different mode.
Oh, what does FE mode?
Most of the calculators, there's an FE button.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay, so that's good to know. So my solution was, okay, kids, just calculate V squared divided by 2C squared. So we're talking about this, and okay, stop. Actually, does anyone have a calculator?
You do.
Okay. So maybe everyone could stop, and actually those who do have calculators, if you could get them out and calculate v squared divided by 2c squared.
And if you don't have a calculator, you can find an app.
Yes. Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, We've done over like fancy screws. I found a few students know it. So then I would walk around the room and walk around the room, so just to kind of break the stage and get away from being this person at the front. Sorry? Yes. So does anyone have an answer? Right, yeah. Okay. So I would check around to see that students, after enough students had gotten it, sometimes I would encourage them. What I did found is students, a lot of students. Okay. So that thing should be an 8 there.
Yeah.
So that's another intentional error.
Sorry, what's the
It served its purpose. Okay. So then I found, what I found at this point is there were maybe 25% of students that were used to. I had 4 kilometers per second. And. And they were used to knowing, okay, the speed of light is 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second, so we get 4 divided by 3 by 10 to the 8, then square that. And if you do that...
No,
X units. Yeah, the units.
Oh, okay.
I know.
Oh, X number.
Yeah. So this is what I found about that third or 25% of students did do, and then you get an answer, there's not by a factor, you get it smaller by a factor of a median. So that was one comment, that was one thing I found. And then you just say, look, are the units consistent? And but then I did find that after a while, so most students did get that. And then, so that's a very small number. And that's an incredibly small number. And that's basically how big or how small the size of the correction in special relativity. So that's every single second, the clocks up in the satellite right above us now actually are ticking slowly by. So for every 1 second they tick, it's roughly one plus. We perceive as one plus that amount of time is having passed. So we actually need to correct for that with our GPS receivers when we're actually calculating how long the signal took to get from the satellite to us. And so you might think, so what that means is that's round about 10 to the minus 10 seconds. So there's this small error, round about 1 tenth of a billionth of a second every single second due to the time dilation formula. And then, I say, look, maybe we don't have to worry about that. It's tiny and nothing's ever perfect. Maybe we can just forget about it. We can just forget about Einstein and relativity. It doesn't matter. But then it turns out that it does matter because that's the time error. But we're dealing with the signals traveling at the speed of light. And even though that's, we want to know a distance. So figure out what distance error that corresponds to if you ignore it, if you forget about it. You have that error in time. And you actually need to multiply that by the distance that light would travel in that amount of time. So now tell students, okay, you know the speed of light is 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second. How far does light travel in 10 to the minus 10 seconds? So if you could get calculators out or calculate that any way you like, with people around you, and then... Okay, hands up, you've got 3 centimeters. Okay. Okay, so 3 centimeters, absolutely. So 3 centimeters, so every single second that you, if you have the GPS receivers and they do not correct for that, you'd be off by 3 centimeters every single second. So you may think, well, again, yes, Paul.
So I just think that there's actually two aspects. The handheld personal GPS is there, kind of plus or minus a couple meters, but when you're looking at people who are in the survey industry using the total station,
right,
it can be down to less than a centimeter error.
Plus or minus a couple millimeters.
Less than a centimeter, so yeah. As long as there isn't any surface effects, like it would be diffracting your signal.
Yeah, I guess it would be depend on the accuracy of the clocks. One thing that would depend on the accuracy of the clocks that they have in their units, that would make a difference. So I suspect that could be a relative. So I guess, so what I've been talking about is just for the stuff you buy from the store.
Yeah.
Yep. That's true. That's a good point. So we have the distance error of 3 centimeters every single second. And if you're hiking and you're off the trail by 3 centimeters, you don't really care. If you're landing a plane, you're off by 3 centimeters. It doesn't matter. So, the kids are thinking, maybe we don't have to worry about Einstein and this isn't really real. But here's where it all comes in. The errors actually accumulate. So that's 3 centimeters you're off by every single second. And if you have a clock that's ticking and it's off by just a tiny fraction of a second after 1 second, it's off by twice that amount after 2 seconds, 3 times, 4 times, etc. So what you need to do to figure out the errors that accumulate over one course of one entire day because of this slow discrepancy due to time dilation formula, you have to figure out how many seconds are there in a day. Well, there are 24 hours in a day. Every single one of them has 3,600 seconds. And so to figure out the error accumulation error in a day, you need to multiply 3 centimeters by 24 hours by 3,600. So if you have a calculator, could you calculate that for me now, please? Calculate without calculating. Phil, yes.
While the calculation's occurring, it might be good in that first bullet there corresponds to what distance error. Write down corresponds to what distance error for each second. And then you know, for the students, you're just highlighting that that error is, in fact, 3 centimeters for every second.
Yeah, that's the point.
And that's a result of not using relativity to help straighten her out, correct?
Yeah. Absolutely. If you just said Einstein, Schmeinstein, we're going to need to. Correct. Yes, absolutely.
The GPS would get out of GPS.
Yes. Yep. Okay. So does anyone have an answer?
Absolutely.
So round about 2.5.
So that's equivalent to the satellite being 2.5 kilometers away from where it, or we think that it's 2.5 kilometers away from where it would actually be at the end of the day.
Roughly speaking, yes.
Satellite?
Yeah, the satellite.
But that translates into us thinking we're 2.5 kilometers away.
Well, the triangulation would be screwed up somehow, but it's not necessarily.
It's not, right, yeah. But roughly, it's in the order of a couple, the same order. So, yeah, so it's a
so
very.
Huge.
Yeah. So this gives you an estimate of just how much you. Really, how much you're often thinking where the satellites are. And that gives you an estimate of error, just how far you would be off track in terms of thinking where you are, your location. Because you've used the satellites to find out where you are. If the satellites are off by 2.5 kilometers, then you're off by 2.5 kilometers. So, 2.5 kilometers every day. So that means if you're, and then I tried to think of the most dramatic example I could. And then I said, so that means that if you're the pilot of a Boeing 747 and you're landing at Toronto Pearson International or wherever airport, Ottawa International Airport if I'm in Ottawa, and you're landing in February and it's a snowstorm, and you think that you're using GPS navigation to help get you on because you cannot see the runway, as many commercial pilots do, and you think that Einstein's theory of relativity is just a theory. It's just something on paper. And so somehow you have this magical button on your GPS receiver and you actually turn it off to not correct for it, or you did that long ago because as soon as you became captain, you just turn it off because it's just a theory. Then at the very least, you're going to be landing on, not on the runway, but 2.5 kilometers away in a field or a road or something like that. And that's probably not going to be a good thing. Yes, Bob.
Now, the time that you're talking about is like, this would be, if they hadn't corrected, this would be out from the instant they put the satellites up in space?
Because
otherwise, so you're not talking about simply the time when somebody turns their GPS on and catches the signal. It's not just that time you're concerned about. It has to be the time from when the satellites were put up in the early 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way you can think about it is if I have two clocks, and then I put one up in, I have two clocks, and one just happens to be bad, or made badly for the plant. So whenever you put the batteries in the back of them and they start ticking, they, you know, one is ticking more slowly than others. It's exactly the same, whether you're measuring it or not. So yeah, that's true. And that can only add to it. Yep, that's a good point. So,
Vivian, that amount of time is accumulated over 10 or whatever years.
Yeah.
From the moment the satellite went up now, so the clock
would
be a lot slower than what time we have on the watch.
Absolutely, yeah, sure. Yep.
I heard that for security reasons, the military scrambles the signal so that we can't get the position that we really can.
So
correction or?
Well, they've said that they don't do that anymore, or they say they don't do that anymore. So they think they did that actually during the first Gulf War. I think that was about 95 from memory. They actually reduced the scrambling. Okay. Oh, sure. Have you got some? Okay. So they actually did that during the first Pershing Gulf War in 95. 5 or whenever it was, they actually scrambled it so that, yeah, so that only, you know, the bad people couldn't actually use it. But supposedly they've turned it off. That's...
Which ones were that?
Sorry? The people on the other side, yeah.
Whichever side that was.
Yeah. So they've turned that off. So apparently, yeah, that's not. But they did that. So only civilians could only get it down to within, I think it was far less accuracy. Maybe it was tens of meters or something like that. Yes, Henry.
Also, that the Europeans are building their own because they're sort of annoyed with the US showing
it. Yeah. Like, yep, so they're building something, I think it's called Galileo, the European Space Agency, that's we networked 30 satellites, and that's due to go online, I forget, or due to start operating, I forget when, but yeah, they are. Because there's billions of dollars of commercial money interest tied up with this. If the US military were to turn the GPS off tomorrow, it would throw so many people out. Businesses, delivery businesses, hikers, I mean, lives would literally be at risk. And so just to have this one system in the hands of the US government and then monopoly, that's, you know, potentially risky.
It's also supposed to be a lot more accurate as well.
Oh, okay, right. Okay. Yes?
Yeah, I'm also just wondering your discussions with high school students on this, if it's a good time to introduce the idea of the geosynchronous orbit.
Right.
The fact that these guys are actually circulating lower.
Yes.
So they rotate around the Earth as a constellation, and just that aspect.
Yeah.
That confuses things, or if it helps things a little bit.
Okay. That could be a good something, a good little side thing you could definitely throw in. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
You could even fit this into grade 11 physics when you talk about orbits and stuff.
Okay.
And why the different altitude and that kind of thing.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
Another example, maybe a little more compelling to the kids, if you took
that number
4-centimeter air and said the airplane's final approach was about 3 minutes.
Right.
And the air that accumulate over that 3 minute descent.
Oh, okay.
So it went too fast.
Right, okay. That's
a little down.
Yeah. Okay, that's actually a good point. Yes, Henry.
Minor correction. The way you do your units, you do MS to the power of -1
for
your KMS. Now it's at kilometer seconds.
Thank you.
But it looks like kilometer seconds now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, yep. Okay, thanks for that. Yep. No, that's a good point.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. One thing I will mention, I just mentioned in passing that actually there are also correction effects due to general relativity, but we won't go into that because they're a lot more complicated. But also, they're actually probably, let me see, they're actually, so they're there, there's another correction, basically there's another correction for general relativity, but we won't worry about that because that just even shows that Einstein is more important. But it turns out that's, so the details, that's actually about 4 times more significant than the special relativity one. It's basically this extra correction, and that changes the time actually 5 times more significant. That changes the time in the other direction, and that's instead of the satellite clocks ticking more slowly, they actually tick more quickly. But because in general relativity, gravity actually slows down time. And depending on the strength of the gravitational field the clock is in, it actually ticks more or less slowly. And the stronger the gravitational field, the actually more slowly it took. So 20,000 kilometers up, gravity is slightly weaker, and so the clocks actually tick faster. So I just say, it's not something I tell students, but just say, look, generally there's this other effect, but that just even shows that Einstein is more important.
Five times,
yeah.
Because
the other direction.
Oh, actually, yeah, it's an order of magnitude. But. So it's 11. It's about 11,000 nanoseconds a day in special relativity, 50,000 nanoseconds a day in general relativity. So that's 39,000 nanoseconds a day. So that's one thing. And then if I have, so that's GPS. So then basically I try and have the slogan, relativity is real. So it's very much a real thing. And then I try and have that quick application sometimes from medical physics. I like to do that, say Einstein is even in hospitals. And this brings in E equals mc squared. I think it's a very cool example. It also involves antimatter. And also, it's got sort of a human aspect, you know, science doing some good and helping people. But relativity equals mc squared is part of that. But there are a number of hospitals around the world. There are brain scans, and brain scans are called PET scans or positron emission tomography scans. And what they do is essentially take some sort of a brain x-ray. It's not really an x-ray, but sort of an image. They're really imaging technologies. And you go inside this machine, and they get some kind of spatial image of your brain. So you can figure out, well, you know, the left hemisphere is doing a lot of thinking, or there's generally not a lot of thinking going on in the brain. Because of red areas generally can indicate there's more thinking, and you can get a snapshot. And they actually use this, I think, for cancer research, detecting brain tumors. But also, it's actually using looking at research in mental illness. And they actually show it pretty fascinating. People say with schizophrenia or with an anxiety disorder, actually have really different brain patterns, different activity occurring. And often people with anxiety disorders have sort of, in a sense, overheated frontal lobes. So there's too much thinking and worrying going on. So that's one area that they use and do some research. Cancer detection, brain research. And the cool thing is they actually involve both quantum physics and special relativity, so you get this double whammy of both theories in there, and also of antimatter, which is very cool. And so what happens is, generally, they inject you with some sort of radioactive liquid. It might be radioactive water with some sort of trace radioactive isotope, and there are a number of ones that they use, such as carbon-15, for example. And they actually make Triumph is one of the places, so the people from BC is one of the places where they actually manufacture these isotopes, and I guess sort of ship them off to hospitals, but you inject people with this radioactive water, then it goes all throughout your body and bloodstream and so forth. Some of it goes into your brain, and so essentially what happens, so it's carbon-15, that actually decays via beta decay. So you get a proton in that, so I think it's a proton decaying into a neutron plus a positron, and I think there's probably a neutrino in there as well. Yeah. So I'll write that.
Actually, isn't it neutron goes to proton, high-speed electron, and antineutrino?
So it's actually, that's beta, normal beta K, but this is kind of, this is sort of beta plus K. So yeah, I should mention that. So it's actually, so this is actually a positron, exactly the same as an electron, except same mass, it has a positive charge. And so it's kind of weird, so a positron. And a positron, turns out, is actually antimatter. That every particle we think has kind of a twin, an antimatter twin, which is exactly the same properties, but it's kind of a mirror image. And if the particle has a negative charge, the antimatter twin has a positive charge. So there's an antiproton, which is negative. Charge of minus one, the positron, positive charge. So so what you actually happen is when you, people that have these, basically there's this radioactive carbon or whatever the isotope is inside their heads, it decays, radioactive materials are inherently unstable, so you actually get antimatter running around inside your head when you have these brain scans. And then I ask students, well, do you know what happens if when antimatter and matter collide and they meet each other? And generally I find one or two students knows does anyone know what happens when antimatter and matter
annihilate?
Absolutely, they annihilate. Does anyone know which formula you use to describe the annihilation process? A equals mc squared. And so they annihilate. So the matter actually disappears, and you get matter being converted to pure energy. And well, how much matter gets converted to how much pure energy? And then you bring in everyone's favorite equation that everyone knows, E equals mc squared. And that actually, you can consider that as a conversion equation. This is how I explain it. That if I have 100 Canadian dollars, and I'm going to the US for a holiday, I take them to a bank, and they take the 100 Canadian dollars and they have some equation and they do something on their computer and they figure out how many US dollars to convert that to. So you convert it from one thing to another. So E equals mc squared is exactly the same, except we're converting from mass to energy in this case. and we need some conversion factor, and it turns out the conversion factor is c squared, the speed of light. And so that's actually very, very, it's huge. I mean, the speed of light is massive in SI units, so speed of light squared, 9 by 10 to the power 16 in SI units, so it's huge. And so what that means is a teeny tiny amount of mass can be converted to a massive amount of energy. And I say, okay, kids, you know, I want to get to do things as much as possible. So I say, okay, the mass of the electron is that. The mass of the proton, the positron is the same thing. So if you get those two masses collide, one positron mass plus one electron mass, because pretty much as soon as the positron is created, it annihilates almost instantaneously with an electron, because there are billions of electrons, there are billions of atoms inside your brain. So the positrons immediately create, hit an electron, they collide, and what they do is they create two photons. So basically it gets converted to pure energy in the term of in the form of two photons, and those photons actually go off in different directions and go streaming outside your brain, and they go out into the machine, and all around your head are these series of light detectors, photo multipliers, and they basically pick up, okay, a photon here, a photon there, where they come from. They basically just draw back lines back into your brain in the middle of the equipment, and then they actually sort of figure out
where in the EM spectrum are the photons in general.
Good question. I don't know actually.
511 keV gamma.
Okay. So if anyone has a calculator, so what I'd like you to do now, if you could figure out how much energy we create from each positron plus electron collision using the equation E equals mc squared. And if you don't have a calculator, do it in your head.
And I'll say some poetry while they're doing that.
Oh, yeah.
This is not mine, it's actually somewhere else. An electron traveling in space met a positron face to face. The electron sighed at the sight of his bride, and they died in a loving embrace.
That's good.
An electron traveling in space met a positron
face to face.
And the electron sighed at the sight of his bride, and they died.
Or at least get an order of magnitude. Does anyone have an answer with the calculator?
Now, site, that's
So is that? So that's for one. I think that's for one electron. But you've got an electron and a positron. So.
Yeah.
So we have 1.6 by 10 to the minus 13 joules, and that's the answer. What I have found a lot of the time for students, about 40% of students, they get half that value because they just take the mass, they put actually the mass of the electron, they put that value in there instead of 2 because you've got 2. And then I just point out the fact that, okay, that's much, much more massive, or it's a large number, but still 10 to the minus 13 joules, I mean, that's minuscule, that's nothing. I mean, each of these lights here is putting out about, I don't know, 40 joules per second, so it's very, 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 very small amount of energy. But then I point out that, you know, you've all heard these examples that if you got the energy, if you got a walnut, something that weighs about 20 grams, and you could, using this conversion equation, have 100% efficiency converting that into energy. A single walnut would give you enough energy to power the entire New York City for about 2 days. And so that gives you some ideas of the power inherent. So it's as if, from this point of view, sort of frozen and tied up in even seemingly sort of small, everyday, tiny amounts of matter, is just vast, vast, vast sort of energy that if you could unlock it, as the sun does in nuclear fusion, but the process is not, it's only, I think, about 1% efficient, it's not anywhere near 100%, then you could have this vast energy source. Yes?
That's sobering reality, isn't it? The piece of uranium they used for the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the actual amount that was converted into energy is about the size of a grain of rice.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Impressive. Yeah. Okay. So that brings us to the end. So. So we had last night the facilitators all got together, and we did a very, very thorough examination process of everyone. We've network of Seabrook cameras actually analysing, making sure that everyone's been understanding everything, and
brain scans.
And it was very, very tough. But I have to say that everyone passed, of course. And so, as a result, we have certificates of professional development participation to hand out to everyone. So we have.